Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. The Census Bureau released new data last week after months of delays. The census has happened every decade since 1790. And overall, the 2020 census shows the country is becoming more diverse. The white population declined for the first time on record since the country's founding. California's population grew by 2.3 million, but that pace fell behind the country's growth, which is why we're losing a congressional seat. Latinos now make up nearly 40% of the population, which is the single largest ethnic group, and the Asian population also grew by 25%, making it the fastest growing ethnic group in the state. All of which is shaping the push to voters, with a recall election fast approaching and midterms about a year out. Hans Johnson is a demographer and senior fellow at the Public Policy Institute of California. That is a nonprofit, nonpartisan think tank. Hans joins us now. Welcome to Insight.
Thanks. Good morning, Vicky.
Well, Hans, obviously the census shapes political maps. It shapes federal spending. When you're looking at the raw census data, what stands out to you in terms of California?
There's so many stories that we're finding now with this release of the census data, which for the first time gives us details on the population in terms of race, ethnicity, and where people live. So I'll just give you a few examples. 12 out of the 13 fastest growing counties in California were in Northern California, and the fastest growing metropolitan region confirmed, based on what many of us had suspected and what estimates by the Department of Finance had suggested, that the fastest growing metropolitan region is the Sacramento region, followed though by the Bay Area, which many people would be surprised by. The Bay Area, for example, grew faster than San Diego and certainly than Los Angeles.
That is interesting because, you know, we have been reporting on or there's been anecdotally talk of this like mass exodus from big areas like the Bay Area and Los Angeles. But when you look nationally at this recent raw data from the census, nationally, the country is becoming more urban. You know, people are moving into larger counties. But I guess, is this the case in California? Because you're talking about Sacramento and the Bay Area. Would you say that California is mirroring what we're seeing nationally?
So I would say rather than mirroring, California has long preceded demographic trends that eventually come to the rest of the country. So, for example, California is one of only a few states where there's no race or ethnic group that constitutes a majority of the population. United States will eventually get there, but it's going to be many decades before they get to that point. You're right about more growth in urban or metropolitan regions. But California, we have this one of the really surprising and to me fascinating trends in our state has been a real hodgepodge of where we've had stronger growth and weaker growth. And look, overall growth has been relatively slow in California this last decade. So almost every county grew slower this decade than it did two decades ago. But the fastest growing county in the state, and I have to put a plug in, this is actually where I lived when I was born, and Weaverville and Big Bar and Trinity County. Trinity County was the fastest growing county in California. That's just absolutely shocking. That's never been the case before. It grew by 17%, which is not a huge increase, but it's not small. It's only went from 13,800 people to 16,100 people. And it was because of another fascinating story of California, which is the increasing diversity of the state. All of that population increase was because of a large increase in the Asian population. In the case of Trinity County, it was because of Hmongs, mostly Hmongs, who had moved up there to work in agriculture and especially in growing marijuana.
What was also interesting was the on record, the drop in people who disclose that they are white. But kind of unpacking what exactly that means, I mean, could this also just be a shift in how people disclose race? I mean, I know I'm multiracial. I'm English, I'm Japanese, and I'm Mexican. I know I'm not alone in that. So is this really a drop in the white population?
So the white population had been declining for some time in California, and it still is. But there's that. But then there's also a change, yes, in how people self-identify. The census also changed how they asked the race question. And without getting into too many details, the Census Bureau asks on the census, what your race is and whether you're Latino or not Latino. And those are two separate questions. So we'll leave that aside for now. But we could do a whole show on the history of how race and ethnicity is collected by the Census Bureau and what it means and how it reflects society, but also kind of changes in perhaps how people think of themselves. In this case, the Census Bureau, for the first time, changed the wording on the race question to, rather than saying check one or more, they changed the wording to check all that apply. And you might not think that would make a big difference. It doesn't make a huge difference, but they had done studies earlier that showed that when they changed that wording, people were more likely to check more races than fewer races. At the same time, I certainly believe that people are starting to know more about their own history and thinking about their own history and their, you know, certainly commercial products like 23andMe and Ancestry.com that you could use to identify where your ancestors originated from. And so I think all of that together played a role in the increase in multiracial. Finally, though, you know, when we look at this by age structure, we know that children are more much more likely to be multiracial than older people. And that reflects changes in marriage patterns and our longstanding trends that we've been seeing occurring in the United States. And again, California being at the forefront of that, followed only by Hawaii, which by far and away has the largest multiracial population in the country.
When it comes to the census, I mean, it gives us such an important glimpse, but it is a glimpse. When it comes to what the census does not show, what are you interested in learning more about?
Yeah, so far what we have, as I said, is some detailed geography and some information on race and ethnicity. But there's a lot more that we're going to be finding out in the coming, actually, years, unfortunately, which include things like educational attainment, income, poverty. And those are, in many ways, the measure of how we're doing as a society, where people are thriving, where they're not. And again, we have some already, we have data that, you know, we know that, for example, housing is a big issue in California, and housing affordability. Eventually, we'll be getting better information about how people's managed or not managed so well through the pandemic. So all of this data we're talking about right now is from April 1st, 2020, which was a long, long time ago in terms of the pandemic. It was at the very start of the pandemic. And so we're going to be looking as more data became available through surveys after the census to look at how California and how different places in California fared through the pandemic.
I think that also just hits home how unique this recent census data is for 2020.
It is. And it was taken, again, at the start of the pandemic. So there were real questions about how accurate this census would be. And those studies still have yet to be completed. On the face of it, for California, the numbers seem plausible. They are fairly close to what had been estimated for the state's total population. And then again, some of these regional variations were a bit of a surprise, but not totally shocking. And as you note, and anybody who lives in Sacramento knows, the strong growth in Sacramento is reflected here in the census and is experienced by people in Sacramento on a day-to-day basis.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with demographer Hans Johnson at the Public Policy Institute of California about the newly released census data and what it means for the state. You know, when it comes to the level of participation with the census, how did we fare with the 2020 census?
So those studies have yet to be completed. The Census Bureau does them, and so does so do independent groups. So over the decade, California grew by over 2 million people. This Department of Finance had estimated that growth was about 200,000 people higher than what the census had actually counted. So that might sound like a lot, but over the span of a decade and given the magnitude of the changes, it's not a huge difference. So from that basis, I think we might think that the census was pretty good, at least for California. California spent tens of millions of dollars to encourage people to participate in the census. Many states spent zero in terms of trying to get their residents to participate. So we'll also be really keen to see whether there was a differential undercount by state. But every census tries to, but doesn't completely count every single person in the census, and people who don't speak English as a first language, people who come from lower income backgrounds, renters, Latinos, African Americans tend to be undercounted more than other groups. So we'll be looking at those numbers as well. But even having said that, we do know that there have been large increases in, as you alluded to in the intro, in the Asian population in California, especially, and still strong growth, although lower than in the past, the Latino population in our state.
The census also showed that there's a decline in children. Is that actually the case, or are children undercounted?
So children tend to be pretty well counted. And in fact, this is something we've observed in California, is a really sharp decline in the birth rate that's occurred over the 10-year period, and especially over the last 5 or 6 years. We wrote a blog post on this at PPIC. What's called the total fertility rate, which is that number of children that a woman is expected to have in her lifetime, has now fallen down to about 1.5 or 1.6 in California. So that's the record low number for our state. And there are real questions, and that's happening nationwide. It's happening for every race and ethnic group in the state and nationwide. And so the question is, will it rebound? And this preceded the pandemic, by the way. So the pandemic, early indications suggest that birth rates have declined even more from the pandemic. Of course, you'd have to wait 9 months to see. And so some of those numbers are still from earlier on in the pandemic. But if that's the case, as we come out of the pandemic, more slowly than perhaps we had hoped, we'll be looking to see whether some of those numbers start to rebound. If they don't, then it means that we're going to be an increasingly older society with fewer young adults. It will mean more schools. We'll have to make decisions about whether they'll close certain schools. And it will mean that we'll have fewer new entrants to the labor market. So there's a lot of big questions ahead for us if those birth rates remain low as they have as they have in California.
Yeah, I mean, the census has such big implications for our future. Looking at the political map, and given the fact that, you know, we have midterms coming up, how will this data shape the redrawing and redistricting that could take place across the state? Especially, we're losing a congressional seat.
Exactly. So as you can imagine, there's going to be a lot of tension about the loss of that seat. California has an independent redistricting commission that makes those decisions. And as I noted at the start, Northern California actually had stronger growth than Southern California. Los Angeles County was one of the slowest growing counties in the state. So when we think about this, it seems reasonable that what we would end up seeing is decline perhaps in Los Angeles County compared to the rest of the state. But it is just one seat out of over 50 seats. So I don't think it's, you know, going to be a tectonic change. But in general, we see the larger urban counties in Northern California, especially almost along this I-80 corridor. And then, you know, I would throw in San Joaquin County in there as well, as being the places that are more likely to gain political representation. So Sacramento and Placer counties were both among the fastest growing counties in the state.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. Hans, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Vicki.
Hans Johnson is a demographer and senior fellow at the Public Policy Institute of California, helping us break down the new 2020 census data. Well, on that note, we do have an exciting programming note to pass along to our audience. Tomorrow night, I, along with two of my fellow journalists from the Sacramento Bee, will be moderating the Sacramento Press Club's debate between four of the Republican gubernatorial candidates seeking to replace Governor Newsom in next 6 months recall election. The debate will be held at the Guild Theater in Oak Park. Cap Radio will be airing that debate Wednesday morning in its entirety at 9 a.m. during our normal Insight slot, followed by a half-hour special with analysis and commentary. So you can join us for this special event 9 a.m. Wednesday morning right here on Cap Radio. Up next, pediatric COVID cases are up. We'll check in with hospitalizations in Northern California. And Cap Radio reporter Sarah Mises-Tan joins us with her reporting on why the Asian American and Pacific Islander community has some of the highest vaccination rates for COVID-19. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. The number of children hospitalized with COVID-19 in the country hit a record high of more than 1,900 over the weekend on Saturday. Now, that's according to data from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, as hospitals, particularly across the South, have been stretched to capacity. Children currently make up roughly 2.4% of the nation's COVID-19 hospitalizations. Scientists aren't yet sure whether the Delta variant causes more severe disease in children, but it's a high degree of infectiousness is a concern, especially as students return to in-person class and children under the age of 12 are not eligible yet to receive the vaccine. So we're going to focus in on Northern California. Dr. Craig Swanson is the medical director of Children's Services at Sutter Medical Center. He joins us now. Dr. Swanson, welcome to Insight.
Great. Thank you very much, Vicki. It's a pleasure to be here.
Dr. Swanson, what are you seeing inside your own hospital?
Well, it's real. We're definitely seeing an increase in COVID in children. We're definitely seeing an increase in severity of illness. Unlike the previous surges, children are becoming quite ill with this disease. There's no doubt about it.
You know, I think that's surprising to a lot of people because we generally think of COVID causing very mild symptoms in children, if at all. But I guess what we're learning is that's not always the case, especially with this variant that's out there.
No, definitely not. The Delta variant is unique. It has some unique properties, and it's definitely impacting children, and we're seeing it.
What are some situations and cases and patients that you're seeing that kind of stick with you that you think the public should know about?
Yeah, well, you know, the virus is acting like a bad virus. It's causing significant pneumonia. We're seeing children who are requiring significant critical care support, mechanical ventilation, et cetera. High levels of oxygen support and receiving all of the care that people know about that's been happening in adults throughout this pandemic, but it's happening in children too. So we're seeing severe critical illness in children due to COVID virus. So far, they're making the way through, but it's definitely a rocky course.
What do you think is making children so susceptible to the virus right now?
Yeah, that's a great question, Vicki. And I think to start with that question, maybe we could start with why weren't they so susceptible the first time around? And to understand that, we need to understand a little bit about viruses. You know, there's sort of three main factors that drive viral movement through a community: the susceptibility of the population, how likely are they to get it, the rate of transmission, how fast does it move from person to person, which is really a function of how sticky the virus is, how much it sticks to literally the cell walls of your nose, for example. And finally, let's say the virus breaks through how sick does it make people, or how virulent is it? What's the degree of damage and illness? And that's direct damage from the virus replicating cells, damaging cells, and indirectly the body's response to that virus. So in the first surges, you know, children were probably just as susceptible as anybody else. But we think that some of the reasons why children didn't get it is they have less of the protein that the virus attaches to. Generally speaking, that amount of protein goes up as you get older, so they were a little less likely to get it. And finally, with respect to the disease itself, once they were to get it, they really didn't have the substantial risk factors that we all know about, so they weren't as likely to get severely ill. And children tend to not have quite the indirect responses, the inflammatory cascades that we've seen in the adult world. So children were likely less susceptible. Fast forward to the Delta variant. Now children are relatively more susceptible because there's less vaccination among the kids and having not had it so much before. The transmission rate is now 2 to 4-fold higher, which just makes it all that much easier for the virus to overcome the relative lack of that protein being available for it to attach to in children. And finally, that we're seeing the direct impacts. And then there's some concern that over the last 18 months, as we've seen an increase in obesity overall, that now we're having more increased risk in that factor. And so now children are more at risk to just get the disease. So we're not seeing sort of that inflammatory cascade they saw in the adult world quite as much, but we're seeing significant direct effect from the virus. So I think that probably puts it together and why we're seeing this.
What are the age ranges of pediatric patients that you're seeing in the hospital?
Well, we are seeing adolescents, and that's generally been what's been around the country as well. There certainly are younger children, but the adolescents are the ones who have been severely ill.
You know, what we've learned about throughout the course of the pandemic is a condition called multi-system inflammatory syndrome in children. Are you getting cases of that as well? And can you just explain what exactly that is?
Yeah. So multi-system inflammatory syndrome in children, MIS-C, is a condition that arises a few weeks after a COVID infection. And it's essentially a reaction to the virus. Reactions to viruses can be very specific just to the virus, or sometimes they can be a little nonspecific and attack the body as well. So it's essentially an immune reaction to the virus that tends to attack other organs within the body. It mimics a disease we've long known about called Kawasaki's disease, so it's very similar. And we're seeing that for sure. The good news with that, Vicky, though, is it's when caught early, it's very treatable. It does require treatment. In the absence of treatment, it can be severely debilitating. But in the presence of a good initial diagnosis and quick treatment, it's very treatable.
What we're also learning more about is, you know, long COVID for individuals who do become infected. Are you seeing this in children as well? And is this likely?
Yeah, I mean, that's primarily a problem in the outpatient world. So I personally haven't managed that as a critical care doctor. However, it's certainly in the literature. There are certainly stories. There are certainly case reports of long COVID in children. And there would be really no reason to think it wouldn't exist in children.
Finally,
so that's just kind of the long-term fatigue, the long-term chest pain, some bright breathing issues, the sensory deficits, et cetera.
Finally, as a lot of families are going back to in-person classrooms, what are your overarching concerns and what will you be focusing on in the weeks and months ahead?
Wow, that's a great question. I mean, that's a big question. How much time do we have?
There is
so much to unpack in this. I the first thing is those are eligible for vaccination. It really does help. And I know I work with a lot of families who are concerned about the vaccine, and there's a lot of understandable, you know, vaccine hesitancy out there. It's new, it's different, et cetera. And what I find is most people are very concerned about the risks and do question the risks of COVID itself in children. So what's the point if I got a risk of this unknown risk of vaccine versus this known minimal risk of COVID? But that rubric has changed. You know, we know the risk of the vaccine is probably a little less than we might have thought. We've been doing it in hundreds of millions of doses now, and so we have a pretty good feel for that. And the risk of the disease itself is now more in children. So the first thing I'd say is for folks who are kind of on the edge on that, you know, the balance has shifted a little bit, and I would, you know, consider vaccination for those who are eligible. In terms of kind of going forward, I'll tell you, I think one of the big things is just to appreciate, first of all, there's a lot of good news, and we'll talk about that in a second, but also that we are where we are. This is going to stay with us. I feel like we've sort of thought that if we shut down everything, it would go away. If we vaccinate everybody, it would go away. If we just let it run its course, some people thought it would go away. But this is just, it's a new disease. It's something we're dealing with. We're getting better at it. And that's the good news. We're getting better. There's better treatments, earlier treatments, better diagnosis. Testing is easily available. Vaccinations are better, and they'll be turned out over time. There'll be more coming. So going forward, you know, we can do this, really. It's we've got to find this way to make it through, to figure out how to get our kids having lives that are satisfying and meaningful, to figure out how to keep teachers safe, to figure out how to keep ourselves safe and use the mitigations, the vaccinations, the treatments, et cetera, to get through this.
I guess finally, you touched upon this, but I think it's important to kind of hit it home and expand on this, given that you're a critical care physician. When you're talking to families who are on the fence about their children getting vaccinated, given what is changing now, what kind of conversations do you have with them?
Well, there certainly have been families, first of all, just to set that up, every patient who's critically ill is not vaccinated. And that's been, I can say that with certainty, and it's been generally true across the country. There's very few patients who are critically ill who are vaccinated. So some families have said, well, this was the risk I was willing to take. And others say, gee, I wish I would have known, right? I mean, you get the full spectrum of responses to that question.
Dr. Swanson, thanks for spending time with us.
All right. Thank you.
Dr. Craig Swanson is the medical director of children's services at Sutter Medical Center, discussing the rise in pediatric cases and hospitalizations of COVID-19. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders, or AAPI communities, currently have some of the highest vaccination rates in Sacramento. Now, that's according to recent Sacramento County data, which split Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders into two categories, showing about 68% of Asian Americans and 67% of Pacific Islanders have been vaccinated against COVID-19. Sarah Mises-Tan is CAP Radio's race and equity reporter. She recently wrote about the high vaccination rates among AAPI communities and joins us now. Welcome back to Insight, Sarah.
Good to be here, Vicki. Thank you.
I guess the big question, what's driving these high vaccination numbers in Sacramento County?
So, you know, from what I've heard, these numbers reflect a number of different sides to this story. So as you mentioned, again, that's 68% for Asian Americans in Sacramento who have received at least one dose of the vaccine, and 67% of Pacific Islanders had the same. Advocates say that, you know, this reflects kind of a whole range of things here for Asian Americans in particular. They've attributed this high rate to a very coordinated effort from both the county level right down to community-based organizations that have really pushed to get people out, knocking on doors and spreading the word on the ground about these vaccinations. There's been a huge push to create in-language services that are offered at specifically Asian American-focused testing sites. You know, there's also a high number of Asian Americans who work in healthcare. And so I think there's a thought that some of that might be attributed to this high rate of vaccination. But of course, there's always a lot more to the story. Asian American is just a very, very broad term, as you're aware of. It encompasses just a huge number of different communities, very different communities that are at a number of different income levels, a number of different immigration statuses, a number of different just immigration patterns and stories. Bobby Dalton Roy has run a vaccine testing site in South Sacramento for the last few months where they've really been pushing to get Filipino Americans in particular out to get vaccinated and get tested because Filipino Americans were having some of the highest rates of contracting the virus in the Asian American community. So here he is.
The Sacramento Alliance for Vaccine Equity started its campaign to make sure that we could get vaccines in or proximate to the communities that were having the highest infection rates, like the 95823 zip code.
You know, when talking about AAPI, it, as you just said, it is such a broad community. There are so many communities within AAPI. So what communities are we exactly talking about?
The good thing is when it comes to AAPI, Sacramento County has actually disaggregated this data. It was not being separated earlier in the pandemic, which advocates said made it particularly difficult to see data when it came to Pacific Islanders and their rates of contracting COVID. Also Filipino Americans who were having very high rates of contracting COVID. It just, when you group us all together or group AAPI all together like that, it's hard to see those nuances come out. But now it's separated. So Asian is defined as, and this is according to the county, quote, a person having origins in any of the original peoples of the Far East, Southeast Asia, or the Indian subcontinent, including, for example, Cambodia, China, India, Japan, Korea, Malaysia, Pakistan, the Philippine Islands, Thailand, and Vietnam. Sorry, that's a bit of a mouthful. And for Pacific Islanders, the county categorizes those as people who are non-Hispanic and a person having origins in any of the original peoples of Hawaii, Guam, Samoa, or other Pacific Islands. You can see it's very particular there.
Yeah, no, and I think it's important to kind of lay all that out so you get, you really get a good picture at how broad the AAPI community is. You know, you were talking about outreach groups and outreach efforts to certain groups. So who's getting the word out about getting vaccinated?
Yeah, there are a number of organizations that have come together around this. There have been folks at the Sacramento Alliance for Vaccine Equity. So this really includes a lot of community-based organizations that serve very particular Asian American communities and Pacific Islander groups. So there's TOFA, which serves Pacific Islanders. There's Asian Resources. There's the Philippine National Day Association. And City Council member Mai Vang's office has also been deeply involved in getting the word out to the South Sacramento community that she serves, which is incredibly diverse. Her office has also been engaged in doing things like door knocking. They're helping to sign folks up for a shot at the Pinnell Center. I know at some point her organization and Hmong Innovating Politics were actually reserving some vaccine appointments at the Pinnell Center, specifically for certain members of certain racial groups, which I think was a really strong outreach effort there. And I think they've actually started to make some of their vaccine clinics more mobile too, to really bring that vaccine out to folks and meet them where they're at.
Yeah. When you actually speak to families about their reasons for getting vaccinated, what are you hearing?
Well, For Asian Americans in particular, I think advocates think that some of the reasons for the higher rate is because there are very high rates of Asian Americans who work in healthcare. Bobby Dalton Roy mentioned that as many as 1 in 4 nurses in California are Filipino American. But he also mentioned that there are a high number of Asian Americans, not just as doctors or nurses, but they're also folks who are serving as caretakers in nursing homes. And that was an industry that was incredibly hard hit by COVID. And so I think a lot of Asian Americans have kind of been on the front line seeing the devastating impact of that virus happening. And that might have made them more willing or just more, I don't want to use the word excited, but, you know, more willing and open to getting this vaccine just because they have seen how bad COVID can get. And for more newly immigrated Asian Americans or Asian Americans who live with elders or older family members, which is also fairly common, some advocates say maybe it's a more collectivistic attitude or greater familiarity with how to handle viruses in general. We even saw that earlier in the pandemic in our Valley Vision poll, if you'll remember, that Asian Americans were a group that was most likely to be following a high number of pandemic precautions, like wearing masks or social distancing. And experts kind of attributed that to maybe just greater familiarity with virus spread in general.
You know, but within those numbers are individuals that are not getting vaccinated. Were you able to talk to people and to kind of get a better sense of why people are choosing not to get vaccinated or they're on the fence about getting vaccinated?
Absolutely. Yeah. So there is absolutely the impact of misinformation that folks are hearing online still, and that impacts everybody. You know, all races included there. And so I did hear some folks who had been worried about the vaccine transmitting a microchip, different misinformation myths. Folks were afraid of the different side effects that would happen from taking the vaccine. And I think there was a lot of concern that some folks who, especially folks who worked lower income jobs or jobs that didn't allow them a whole lot of time off, that they would have intense side effects and be too sick and not be able to take that time off from work. So they'd been putting it off for a long time. I think those were kind of the factors I was hearing.
Yeah. Given that the AAPI community is in the high 60 percentile when it comes to vaccination rates, I mean, just hearing that, I feel like that's higher than a county average. So I guess how is the AAPI community stacking up with other communities in terms of vaccination rates?
Yeah. You know, I guess they are still by far and away the highest number of groups that have been vaccinated in the county. I would say for white people, Black people, and Latino people, those numbers were closer to about 30 to 40%. And so you see that actually for Asian Americans, that figure is almost double, yeah. I would say, which is surprising and incredible. And I know that advocates say that they really attribute that 100% to the intense outreach that they've been doing, just really trying to get that word out. But, you know, the numbers look very different for Pacific Islanders, so I don't want to lump them all together. Elise Tulua, she's a project director at the Data Policy Lab at UCLA. They study specifically Pacific Islander rates of getting vaccinated and also Pacific Islander death rates from COVID because it was so high. She told me that others fear that the high vaccination numbers for Pacific Islanders in particular may actually be overinflated. Here she is.
We wish that we could celebrate that as an accomplishment and, you know, a shining achievement of our work. But unfortunately, I don't think that's the case.
Well, I guess when you hear that, I mean, do we have a sense of what the numbers actually look like?
Yeah. So I would say that the Data Policy Lab has been keeping tabs just through like community-based organizations, things like that. And I would say they think their numbers are closer to about 40 to 45%, which tracks more closely with other racial and ethnic groups that we're seeing in Sacramento.
Is there also just a concern? I mean, we were just talking about how broad the Asian American Pacific Islander community is. Is there just a concern about, you know, kind of talking about overgeneralizing this community and the implications Absolutely. That could have?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. You know, I think Pacific Islanders in particular have been so concerned about their community getting lumped into this Asian American category because it does tend to inflate their rates, because Asian Americans is such a broad group of people and they encompass a very broad group of income levels. You know, earlier in the pandemic, I know that we at Cap Radio have done some coverage just on Pacific Islanders having some of the highest rates of contracting the virus. And that was something that was very hard to see if you were to look at the county data for, this is before they were disaggregating that data, the AAPI category, you would not have seen that Pacific Islanders were suffering so much. Yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
And I guess, does that lead into what we were talking about previously about misinformation? And what are you hearing about that?
Yeah, you know, there's absolutely been misinformation that has impacted the Pacific Islander community. When I did speak with some folks who are Pacific Islander who had been vaccine hesitant, they mentioned just that the community has a background in more natural or herbal medicines. And so, you know, this is just one person in particular, I don't want to generalize, but for them, they felt that, you know, they could fight this virus on their own, that this was something that they could naturally fend off without having to take something like a vaccine. So there was hesitance there. They mentioned that many members of the Pacific Islander community are very religious, and so that's played a role in them not wanting to get the vaccine. They felt that God would just, you know, take care of their needs and take care of them. But the person that I did speak with in particular had said that her entire family actually did suffer from getting COVID. And that was absolutely part of the reason why they eventually decided that they should get vaccinated. She saw the fear on her sister's face, she said, when her sister got COVID. And in the end, just this past summer, they decided, you know what, let's get the vaccine. This isn't worth the risk.
Yeah. When you're talking to advocacy organizations, what are they telling you?
You know, they warned that this rate is just not a true reflection of what's going on in these communities. You know, I think in particular, they said that some of these rates might be very high because there just isn't a very accurate count of the Pacific Islander population in general, especially when you get to communities in California that don't have very many Pacific Islanders or may not have a great handle on what that community is like. That's how you start to get, you know, if you look at the data specifically for Los Angeles County and you look at the Pacific Islander rate of vaccination, they actually don't give a percentage of that population. And there's an asterisk there. And it actually says that the number of vaccinations that they're counting for Pacific Islanders actually exceeds the county's count of its population of Pacific Islanders. And that's due, I think we're going to, I'm sure you have a lot of questions now, but that's due to a ton of factors.
Yeah. And I think it just really hits home that numbers are nothing without context. So Sarah, thanks for helping us sift through of that, have a wider perspective on the data that we're getting when it comes to COVID-19 vaccines and the AAPI community.
Absolutely. A lot to do here. Thank you.
Sarah Mises-Tan is Cap Radio's race and equity reporter. Still ahead, photojournalist Paul Kitagaki Jr. joins us to talk about the encore of his traveling exhibit, which covers the mass incarceration of Japanese Americans during World War II and the resilience of those who went through it. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Mm-hmm. Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. The California Museum announced this month an encore presentation of the exhibit Gambate, Legacy of an Enduring Spirit. The traveling exhibit is open to the public right now and will continue on through November 7th, featuring contemporary images taken by photojournalist Paul Kitagaki Jr. and historic photos by the U.S. War Relocation Authority, who documented the mass incarceration of Japanese Americans during World War II. Now updated and expanded for 2021, Gambate returns with dozens of new photographs, audio interviews, and much more. Paul Kitagaki Jr. is a senior photojournalist at the Sacramento Bee. His work has been published in National Geographic, Time, Sports Illustrated, and other news outlets around the world, as well as honored with dozens of awards, including the Pulitzer Prize. Paul joins us now. Nice to see you, Paul. Welcome to Insight.
Hey, Vicky. Thank you for having me today.
Well, before we get to your exhibit, you just returned from Tokyo covering the Olympics. You've been quite busy, which is not uncommon for you.
Yeah, I was really lucky to cover my 10th Olympic Games, and it was pretty incredible. I mean, even though there was no fans allowed at the Games, it was still incredible to be there at the Olympics Games.
You know, when it comes to the name of your exhibit, Gambate, what does it exactly mean?
You know, Gambate is kind of this Japanese word, which means to triumph over adversity, never give up. And I really think that it really embodies the spirit of all my, you know, my parents, my grandparents who suffered through this during World War II.
Yeah. Can you talk to us a little bit about your family history and really just kind of deepening this connection that you have to this work?
Oh, yeah. It wasn't until like 1970, I was in 10th grade and I was taking a U.S. history class. And I learned in the class that my parents and grandparents were incarcerated in prison camps during World War II. And I was like totally shocked because they had never spoken about this at home. And there's so many other Japanese families that American families that the parents or the grandparents never spoke about their experience and what happened to them during World War II. So really, at the time, you know, as a young teenager, made me kind of mad because how can they do that? They're American citizens. How can they lock them behind barbed wire? So it's created a lifelong journey for me of discovery to learn what happened to them and their experience.
You know, and then now coupled with that, as a journalist, it really also, I would imagine, allows you to go from a personal connection to also looking through this at a wider lens. How has being a journalist allowed you to continue to explore something that's just so integral to your life and your family?
Yeah, what's really incredible is the National Archive, one of my I guess my most favorite photographers, Dorothea Lange, and she had the most emotional photographs of the incarceration experience. She photographed in the Bay Area, she was from the Bay Area, and there over 900 of her images are in the library. The National Archives,
yes,
in Washington, D.C. So my uncle just told me that Dorothea Lange had photographed her family. I'm like, wow, I wonder what this photograph looks like. It's like my most favorite photographer, documented photographer, she's famous. So I years ago in 1984, I went back to the National Archives and I was looking through all these boxes. They bring out these boxes of these 4x5 pictures, and I'm flipping through these boxes looking for this image. I had no idea what it looked like. And I finally discovered this image in one of the last boxes. But as I was flipping through those boxes, all these faces were staring up at me. And I really wanted to know what happened to all these people, because all these pictures they're nameless. There's no names on a lot of these photographs. A few have names, but mostly they're a mystery. So I really wanted to know what happened to all the people in the photograph, who they are, what happened, how this experience shaped their lives.
You capture such intimate moments in your work. Can you just talk to us about a couple that really resonate with you?
Yeah, my first subject was Yuki Uwelman, and there's a picture of her from Clem Albers, and she's 2 years old. She's sitting on her luggage at the Union Station in Los Angeles, eating an apple in this really nice outfit. And she was one of the first subjects I connected with outside of my family. And it wasn't the only way I was able to connect with her was through I took a poster board of some of my favorite images back in, 2006 to the Japanese American Buddhist temple here in Sacramento, hoping to get a hit on, hey, look at these photos, call me up, this is going to be great, right? And I got not one call. So then somebody said, go down to the Japanese American Methodist Church in Sacramento. So I went there and I got my first connection with Yuki. So I photographed, so she was coming on a pilgrimage from, she worked in Illinois and she was a assistant dean of Asian studies at in Illinois at a university. So she's coming out to Los Angeles to the Japanese American National Museum to discover her roots. And then we're going to go meet and go out to Manzanar. She hadn't been there since, she was a child when she left in 1945. So it was really incredible. We went out there. We went to the exact same spot where she lived with her mom. She discovered that her mom had said that her dad had died, but in reality, she found years later in 2005 that her dad was alive. He had another family there in camp.
Wow.
And so she discovered all these other different things like that. And she also discovered, she grabbed a little bit of dirt and kept that. But she said, during one of her interviews, she goes, she really didn't get a feeling of that she was there. You know what I mean? Even though she was standing there right now, because she was so young as a child being there. Hmm.
I mean, you've documented Japanese internment throughout your career, and I think just having this encore exhibit with additional photos and interviews just shows that there's much more to do and much more to unwrap.
Yeah, since my exhibit debuted here at the California Museum in 2015, I had 30 images. Since then, it's grown to 61. And we're showing 30 new pieces. And then I also have 5 new ones that I haven't finished yet that I'm doing. One was this animator for Disney in Hanna-Barbera. He did Scooby-Doo. Yeah. He did The Lady and the Tramp, the spaghetti scene. It was really incredible. And he's still alive. He's in Los Angeles right now. So I have 5 new people I'm doing so far. So I'm really hoping to share their stories. And they're really... they want to share their stories because a lot of people don't want this to happen to any other group again in history.
Yeah. Yeah. Words are also so important here. I mean, we're talking about internment versus incarceration. I mean, what does that mean to you and how do you differentiate between the two?
There's so many different words people use. They use concentration camp, prison camp, incarceration camp, internment camp, and the government camp name was War Relocation Center. Which is very tame. So, I mean, the JCL is using the term incarceration. But when I was a kid, I remember the first book I read was American Concentration Camp. And then, a lot of my subjects are saying it's a concentration camp too. It's prison camp, So there's so many words are powerful and there's so many different ways to say it. Some people say, well, if it's a concentration camp, it's not like Auschwitz because nobody went to, had that awful tragedy mm-hmm. with them, but it was still, they're locked behind barbed wire. The guns were pointed in toward the camp, not out to protect them. So, it was a prison camp.
Finally, just hearing how obviously passionate and how deeply embedded covering this and putting together this work is, when you first took in the exhibit, how did you feel? I would imagine walking around, it was emotional.
Oh, it was pretty incredible to, I was really surprised when I was able to start photographing people and finding people. That was like the most important thing to me. And it was really incredible. When I had the first 12, we had an exhibit on the 70th anniversary, and that was in 2012. And we had a exhibit at the BART station in San Bruno, which is the same area San Bruno was where Tamfran was, which was with the racetrack, which where many of the Japanese Americans in the Bay Area went, over 7,000. That's where my grandparents, my dad went. And we drive by that place when I was a kid, and my parents never spoke about it, this is where we were in camp. And that was where the first exhibit is. There's a permanent exhibit there now. But it was really incredible to do that. And then when we had the opening here, and I've shared it over 16 places so far across the nation. And I'm still trying to get in into the South and other areas like in Civil Rights Museum, just to share and bring that story to more people.
Thank you so much, Paul, for sharing your work. His exhibit featuring Japanese Americans who survived mass incarceration during World War II is now on display at the California Museum. And with that, that is Insight for today. We'll see you back here tomorrow.